The Word of Mouth podcast from NHPR is made possible with support from you, our subscribers, and from
Heinemann, a provider of resources written by real teachers for real classrooms. Heinemann values teachers as decision makers and students as curious learners. Discover the path to lifelong professional learning at Heinemann.com. Heinemann, dedicated to teachers.
You're listening to Word of Mouth, your questions answered, your state explored. I'm Justine Paradise, and I'm here in the studio with Taylor Quimby and Hannah McCarthy.
Hey, Justine.
Hey.
Hey, guys. So, Hannah, you and our producer, Nick Capodice, who produced our first story today, you covered the history and the design of the American flag for Civics 101, our sister podcast.
We did indeed.
Yeah. So what did you find out about the American flag design?
A number of things. Primarily, it was not designed by Betsy Ross, or it probably wasn't, which a lot of people...
The myth and the legend.
The myth and the legend of Betsy Ross. But my favorite fact about the American flag is that initially, you know how we were adding stars for every state? As every state was added to the nation, we would add a star.
Right, 50
stars.
That's
why we've got 50 stars.
Yeah.
We don't have 50 stripes, though, right?
Right. No, 13
like,
stripes.
Yeah, I was going to say about a dozen. Was
Baker's dozen.
But initially, they did add a stripe for every state that was added. And somebody, thank God, was like, yeah, this is going to look totally nuts if we have 50 stripes.
They would be like as thin as straws.
Yeah.
It would be like a Where's Waldo t-shirt.
Exactly.
It would look insane.
It
like
would
a
be
piece
really
of modern art. Yeah.
Disorienting. Yeah.
I think the American flag could have had a cat on it.
It could have made it better. Or put a bird on it.
Where would you put a bird? Where would you put the cat, Taylor?
In the field of stars.
Yeah.
In the middle.
Yeah.
Surrounded by stars.
Are you thinking like the full cat body or just the head?
Just a head.
Yeah.
Just a head.
I'm thinking that too.
Yeah.
The American flag avoided a design pitfall.
Right.
At least one design pitfall. But some state flags are not so lucky. So our producer, Nick Capodice, has the story of New Hampshire's state flag.
Earlier this week, I tried this experiment with some colleagues at the station, where without telling them what they were, I would take images of U.S. state flags and put them in front of them.
Okay. So what calls to mind, like my
emotional... Yeah, what are your initial... First, I'd show them the state flag of South Carolina.
It feels that really nice, temperate summer night. Like all the oppressive heat of the day is gone, and now the nighttime is just yours to go out.
I think there's something about the palm tree standing alone in this sea of nothingness. It's unnatural. Like it's symbolic of something, like it's a harbinger of something, it's a sign.
That's a place I would want to, you know, lean up against with a book.
Then I'd show them the Zia sun symbol, the red and yellow flag of New Mexico.
Oh man, I just think of this road trip I took across the country through the Southwest.
But it just seems like it's representative of the sun. It's red and it looks like there are rays coming out of it.
For some reason, Atari jumped into my head when I saw this. I don't know why.
Just the sun above just pouring down and just... you know, just eviscerating everything on the landscape. Just total domination from the sun because it's just like, that is the sun's territory and we're just passing through.
And then, finally...
New Hampshire. How I love our home state. Okay, so let's unpack this.
Why are you laughing?
I'm laughing because what I'm looking at is the seal of the state of New Hampshire on a blue background.
I don't know what any of this represents. Like, there's nothing here that says, like, yeah, that's New Hampshire.
You've got a dock, but it looks like there's a rock on the dock and a river flowing over the dock itself. And then you've got a ship in the background with flags all over it and a sun rising.
I noticed the rock. I don't know the significance of it.
It
looked like
granite.
It looked like it was just kind of thrown in there.
That's right. The New Hampshire state flag. You know what's on it, right? It's got a big boat. It's got two separate wreaths, one with the stars and a laurel wreath, and there's a big old rock in the front, and it says Seal of the State of New Hampshire 1776 all around it. Quick caveat. Full disclosure. Before I even started to work on this piece, I went to my executive producer, Erica Janik, and I said, can I be upfront about my feelings about the New Hampshire state flag? And she said, yes. So here it is. I strongly dislike our state flag. I like boats. I like seashores. I like Portsmouth. I love history. Love it. But I hate. Oh, no, I don't say hate. I strongly dislike our flag. The main reason is that a bunch of years ago, I heard a podcast called 99% Invisible, which is fantastic, by the way, about vexillology, the study of flags. And the top consultant for that podcast episode about flag design is Ted Kay. Ted Kay wrote a book called Good Flag, Bad Flag, where he outlined the five simple rules, the five do's and don'ts for a good flag. And New Hampshire breaks every one of those five. As a matter of fact, the North American Vexillological Association did a survey of all the flags of the US and Canada, that's 72 in total, and it ranked them from best to worst. New Hampshire came in 63rd place. Whew! Ooh, 63rd out of 72. So I wanted to find out, what's on our flag? Why? Is it really that bad? And if it is there anything we can do about it?
A state rep from the Upper Valley thinks it's time to spruce up the state flag. Democrat Timothy Josephson of Canaan wants a new commission to redesign the flag, and he'd like to help New Hampshire's banner stand out.
That's not to say I have anything against our current state flag. I have one proudly waving at my house and have been ever since I moved there. But I just think it's time for a refresh, an update.
House Republican leadership opposes the idea of forming a new commission, saying there are already too many commissions and they like the flag the way it is.
House Bill 1242. Establishing a committee to study redesigning of the state flag. Tim Josephson introduced this bill and went to committee, and it was inexpedient to legislate. Now, that means it's a no-go, by the way. Bills either get an ought to pass or inexpedient to legislate, and it's usually the latter. We sometimes joke that there's a RoboCop-like cyborg in the House that just says
inexpedient to legislate.
In 2017, 2018, so far there's been about 2,000 bills considered by the legislature, and about 200 of those have passed.
Right. Have you ever heard of Tuba Christmas?
So he might have failed, but I called him up. I called him up and I asked him if he'd want to come into the studio and tell me his reasoning for proposing this bill.
This is something that I've always been thinking of ever since I've lived in New Hampshire. I've lived in New Hampshire for 18 years now. I've always lived on the western side of the state. And it's always struck me as odd that a state with the smallest coastline has a big ship on our flag. Nothing against the flag. I really don't have it. I like it. It's nice and all. But I just thought it was possibly time to take a look at redesigning our state flag. I remember reading an article about state flags in general maybe 10 years ago.
Tim and I had read the same article about the North American Vexillological Association and Ted Kay's book, Good Flag, Bad Flag.
But essentially the same formula.
So that guy's name is Ted Kay.
Okay.
And yesterday I talked to him for an hour.
Oh, no kidding.
About your proposal.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
And so here's what he had to say. I'm just going to play some tape for you.
Yeah,
we can talk
sure.
about it.
Oh, wow.
The New Hampshire flag is a flag that we call an SOB flag. That's a seal on a bed sheet. The New Hampshire flag has the state seal on a blue background, which makes it virtually indistinguishable at a distance from 23 other state flags. Nearly half of the U.S. flags are a seal on a blue background. And that makes it really hard to represent New Hampshire in a group of flags when they all look the same. The ship that appears on the New Hampshire flag is on the state seal. That's the frigate Raleigh, which was built for the Continental Congress for the Revolutionary War. And that was built on Badger's Island, which was in then the colony of Massachusetts across the river from Portsmouth. And now that's in Maine. And so that means that New Hampshire is depicting an image of another state on its flag.
Oh, dear.
But it was very, I think it is appropriate that shipbuilding was very important to the history of New Hampshire and Portsmouth. And that's a reasonable thing to put on a state seal. It's just not smart to put a state seal on a flag. Mm-hmm. When you consider what flags do and what seals do, flags are meant to be recognized at a distance on a piece of fabric, flapping, moving, and seen on both sides. Seals are meant to be seen close up on a piece of paper, not moving, and only on one side. Seals have an incredible amount of detail on them that just can't be seen on a flag. And so confusing the use of a seal with the use of a flag means that you can understand why seals don't belong on flags.
There has been some movement in the last few years to add words to our current flag, specifically our state motto, Live Free or Die.
Live Free or Die belongs on the license plate, not on the flag. Lettering does not reverse well, therefore you need to have a dual thickness flag to have letters on your flag. Otherwise, for example, Kansas's flag says Saznak on the back. If you put words on a flag, if you put the name of your state on your flag, that means your symbolism has failed. Can you imagine the flag of France saying France on it?
No. Or the American flag just saying USA kind of in the,
right,
in the top.
We laugh
corner.
At that.
Yeah.
Why don't we laugh at that when we're looking at a state flag? It is laughable that we need to explain the symbols on a symbolic object.
So what'd you think of all that?
It was hard to not bang my head on the microphone here out of frustration here because...
One of State Rep. Josephson's biggest frustrations with her flag is that it depicts a boat and an ocean. So I wanted to give the historians a crack at this one.
Some people wonder what's going on here because New Hampshire doesn't have much of a seacoast. Yeah, we have about 18 miles of seacoast and all these big mountains. My name is R. Stuart Wallace. I am a professor of history at NHTI, Concord's Community College. Keep in mind that we were one of the slowest growing provinces ever in among the 13 colonies. We started out on the seacoast in 1623 when Europeans first settled there permanently. And it took us 100 years to get out of the seacoast. We were just there, stuck there. But we were a shipbuilding state. The seal actually changed several times. Every time the seal wore out, they'd turn it over to somebody to cast a new die. And the guys who casted the die started to embellish it. And so they wound up adding things to the seal.
Are you telling me the changing of the seal is purely utilitarian? It's because the actual metal cast has worn
the
off.
The metal cast has worn off. And so when they commissioned a new seal to be made, the guys who made the die said, well, why don't we change it a bit? And so they put in some barrels. They had timbers in there. But then they put some people in. They actually had little people running around in front. And so after a while, we said, wait a minute, this has got to stop. We got to have to, if it's an official seal, which is for authentication purposes, we got to have a real seal.
Why? What's the point then?
What's the point of what?
Having a boat that's not even in our state.
Because it's so old.
These are the high school students of Tom Mungoven. He runs the Concord Regional Tech Center at Concord High. These are young graphic designers, and they also did not care much for a flag.
When I look at that, I don't see New Hampshire.
It's also breaking the no text rule, because from a distance you can't read any of what that says.
It just tells you that it's a flag. I think I know it's a flag.
There's just so much blank space that could be used with the detail that's all kind of compressed into one spot.
I asked them if they'd be willing to come up with a better design, and they said sure.
Well, I was trying to do something with the state flower, and I didn't want to make it too purple, so it was like, hey, wow, this is a purple flag, but just like enough so it kind of reminds you of that color. And then I was thinking of adding some white stripes, like vertically, to kind of represent the birches.
I just have a triangle, kind of like a mountain, with the blue, and then nine stars with one in the middle.
I've grown up in New Hampshire, and a lot of things that I remember were when the leaves would change color, we'd go on like the Kangamangas Highway and look at all the leaves changing color.
So what you've done is unlike what anybody else has done. You've chopped up our current flag.
Yeah, that was my approach, was just to deconstruct what we already have.
Radio does not do justice to the beauty and power of these flags.
I kind of drew our history with the Native Americans, so I'm looking at the Abenaki because when I was younger, we learned a lot about what they did in the tribes and how it influenced New Hampshire.
Could you describe what's on your flag for our listeners?
Yeah, I have a rocket ship in the middle, and it's just surrounded by some stars, and it has a plain color background around it. New Hampshire, two of the most important people who are trying to go to the moon, Chris McAuliffe and Alan Shepard are from New Hampshire. So, just want to incorporate that.
How's the spaceship coming along?
I'm just trying to find the color scheme. It's not really working out well, but I'll get there at some point.
So now we have some amazing designs. We have a state rep who's interested. What do we do next? Again, Ted Kay.
I think it's important for people who want to change the flag to find a way to motivate the public to embrace the cause and use that embrace of the cause to advance it among the elected officials. There are movements all over the country. Hundreds of cities are seeing redesign movements. And in Vermont, Montpelier and Burlington have done that. There's a little bit of rivalry between those two cities, of course, and that led to that. But I challenge Vermont and New Hampshire to see who can come up with a great state flag first.
What do you think about that?
I think it's on. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, our flags are so identical. I know we're the twin states, but that doesn't mean we have to have twin flags. Anything to get Vermont's goat goes over pretty well.
you have to find your version in Vermont.
That's right.
Hello?
Hello, is this Sam?
Yes, it is.
Well, the reason this is Samuel Young, who's one of the younger representatives in Vermont. I told him about what you were going through, and this is what he said.
I'm interested in the in vexillology. I was actually testifying in a committee earlier this year that was talking about flags, and I was just saying that we should, you know, consider, you know, branding ourselves a little better.
Have you given any thought to what could be possibly on the new Vermont flag?
You know, it's. I think it's something where I would rather kind of crowdsource it, kind of create some excitement throughout the state around it too. You know, get artists to submit their, you know, best work, get the most talented Vermonters to, you know, put it forward.
All right. Well.
All right.
Thank you so much for talking to me today.
Well, you know, it just, you know, in a little good natured Vermont New Hampshire rivalry, you know, we should have the contest, but I'm sure that ours would come out better.
So he's down.
Yeah, I like it. I'm going to get his contact info, definitely.
Do you agree with the representative from Vermont that in the competition, Vermont will win?
No, not at all. Not at all. I think we have an enormous number of creative people here in the state, and I think that they can definitely come up with something that is truly representative of our unique individuality here. So I have all the confidence and faith in the people of New Hampshire.
You hear that, Vermont? New Hampshire's calling you out. And if Mr. Mungovan's class is any indication, we have nothing to worry about.
That was our producer, Nick Capodice, on the New Hampshire state flag. Did you guys see those designs from the Concord High School students?
They were amazing.
They were so good.
So good. I think, what was your favorite?
My favorite, it was a yellow background with, I think it was yellow, yeah. Yellow background with a red spaceship with three stars over the spaceship. And yes. I just thought that was pretty rad.
So great.
I was a big fan of the bold design that was basically, it was basically two triangles, or I guess three triangles on the top.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Then the bottom was just a sort of a color field. I don't know my flag terms.
It was like color blocking kind of, but that was the notches, right?
Yeah. Basically, mm-hmm. It was like two triangles that were mountains on the top that created a notch, and the bottom was maybe blue for a lake.
Yeah.
And it was very simple, but once you looked at it, you were like, I get it.
And then there's the idea of just having it be a single color, like lilac.
Yeah.
That's real bold.
To see these amazing ideas for the New Hampshire flag designs, because truly we cannot capture them on the radio, visit them at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, and we'll put a link up. Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Justine Paradise here in the studio with Hannah McCarthy.
Hey, Justine.
And Taylor Quimby.
Hello, hello.
So this year, 2018, it's been 100 years. It's the centennial of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. Does that mean anything to you?
It's both a treaty and an act.
It's the act codifies the treaty. So Congress,
oh, all right.
It's Congress's version of the treaty, yeah.
It sounds very pleasant.
It's a pleasant thing. So it's a treaty that we signed with Canada in 1918. 100 years ago. And the MBTA provides that it is unlawful to pursue, hunt, take, capture, kill, possess, sell, purchase, barter, import, export, or transport any migratory bird or any part, nest, or egg unless you get like a special permit, basically.
I was going to say, I can't even barter a bird.
You can't even.
Yeah, they really covered their bases, their bird bases.
Yeah, can't even barter, can't possess. Which is actually kind of funny because James Audubon was like the master painter, and also every bird that he painted, he killed. So
right?
It's
I've
kind of funny. Yeah.
Well, they're hard to get to stay still.
So no, not great. But the Audubon Society credits this treaty with helping save a number of different birds: the snowy egret, the wood duck, the sandhill crane. But the funny thing is that almost every bird is a migratory bird, so it protects over 1,000 species in the United States.
So you basically can't touch anything but a chicken.
Essentially.
All right.
Or turkey.
Oh, turkey. Sure, yeah, yeah.
But this is only a treaty between Canada and the U.S.
It's so expanded since then, so it also includes like Mexico and a few other countries. But so it's the centennial, and I wanted to know, you know, how do you go out and actually witness the spring migration besides, you know, looking at a bird and saying that bird probably migrated? What does it mean to see the migration?
So, Justine, you went birding.
Hannah? I sure did.
The little community of, I think, Bonaparte's gulls. You see the little white dots on the log in the middle of the river?
The white dots on the log. I don't think I see the log yet. The Connecticut River is calm and slow at this particular bend at Hinsdale, New Hampshire. We're on the rail trail, which runs along the riverbank, looking across to Vermont. And Eric Masterson is setting up his spotting scope and pointing out a group of 8 Bonaparte's gulls, perched in a row on a log in the middle of the river. They're beautiful, the black head there.
Yeah, black head. And they just passed through on migration. And they're following the river north. They breed, they're an unusual bird. They breed in old nests, like songbird nests, like a robin's nest in a spruce tree up in the boreal belt.
Eric Masterson works at the Harris Center for Conservation Education in Hancock, New Hampshire. He started birding when he was 11 in Ireland, where he grew up. And in April, we went on a walk.
These birds, Bonaparte's gulls. Lucien Bonaparte was a nephew of Napoleon, and he was a noted ornithologist, and so these are named in his honor. Have a look again. They're pretty cool birds.
So pretty. They've got these black heads. Pure white bodies. Just chilling on a log.
Yeah, that's really a cool sighting. They're not, I wouldn't call them rare at this time of year, but they're symptomatic of, they're a classic migrant bird in the lower Connecticut River Valley. And when you see them, you basically are looking at migration. They're not going to be here in a month. Most people's experience with migration is they wake up in the morning, they look out the window, and there's an oriole at their feeder. Basically, the oriole spent the winter in perhaps Mexico, and the summer it's going to spend in New Hampshire. And so there are two ends of a terminus. And the spectacular event is the journey between. And so you look out your window and you see the oriole, you're seeing an end of that journey, you're not seeing the journey itself. And so it's hard. I mean, how do you see a journey?
How do you see a journey? When bird migration happens mostly unseen at night, over the open ocean or thousands of feet above us, and when you're in love with migration, how do you see it? There's an idea in birding, a practice of keeping a list to keep track of the species you've seen. You can have a year list, a yard list, a life list, a world list. And to be honest, I've spent a little time at the edge of the birding world, and back in school I studied ecology, so I used to take part in an owl banding project, and I participated in the Christmas bird count once or twice. And sometimes I feel like that listing attitude can lean a bit towards a collecting mentality, which just isn't for me. And maybe this is unfair, but that's meant I've kind of kept my distance from the birding community. So something I kind of like about Eric is that he doesn't keep a list. He says for some people, keeping a list is great, and it can be a doorway to conservation, it's fine. But he's interested in migration, not the total sum of species he's seen. A few days before our sighting of the Bonaparte's gulls at the Connecticut River, Eric and I had tried to go on another walk at Horseshoe Pond in Concord. But this April was cold and miserable, and even though the sun was out on that particular day, the wind was up, and I recorded what is probably the worst audio I've ever recorded in my life.
The early bird gets the worm, excuse the pun. The early migrant gets the best breeding territory, but they take a real risk, and so this year...
We saw a handful of birds, but really, migration hadn't started yet. The birds that had bravely flown north early, the tree swallows and the phoebes, many of them were struggling.
Because if you're an early bird in spring, and you hit April that we have this year, it can really be catastrophic. And so I had calls last week from people who were reporting dead phoebes. I suspect a lot of the tree swallows perished. The early tree swallows perished.
So the audio was bad and there weren't many birds and we didn't stay long. But Eric gave me a ride back through the city traffic.
I personally think that migration is one of the great natural wonders of the world and doesn't get bird migration and doesn't get the respect it deserves.
Why is it one of the great natural wonders?
Because it's phenomenal. You have billions of animals traveling across continents every year. Billions. And then they come back north in the spring. They do it through amazing ways that, and they don't have technology. They don't have an iPhone. They don't have a car. They don't have an airplane. It's the bird, the sun, and the earth. And they're doing these amazing journeys with at great risk. You know, the mortality rate for these creatures is 50%. In the order of 50% for some species. 100 will head down in the fall and 50 will come back north in the spring.
Eric devotes a lot of his time to getting closer to the bird migration. Again, most birds migrate at night because it's calmer, less turbulent, there are fewer predators, they can see the stars. But that means to most people that migration is invisible. So, on calm spring nights, Eric sets up recording equipment in his yard in Hancock to listen for it instead.
I have a parabola and a mic, and so I've recorded about 160 species, I think, give or take, over my house over the years, and most of them I've never seen.
This is a compilation Eric cut together of some of the best moments from last spring. It's about a minute long. And Eric doesn't stop at recording bird calls. He also bicycled 6,000 miles to Panama along the migratory route of the broad-winged hawk, which actually flies during the day and is one of Eric's favorite birds. And he's not stopping there either. As we're driving back through the city traffic, returning from our walk that cold April day, he tells me that he's actually learning to hang glide.
What is that story? To understand a person, you have to, with that old adage, to understand a person, you have to walk in their shoes.
So not only studying and watching the migrants, you're now going to join them.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it sounds crazy, and a lot of people would say it is, but I've always been inspired by the natural world, and I just the thought of it just I find wonderful. So yeah, it's a dream, and if you don't have dreams, you're not living right. I'm not trying to suggest this is a scientific endeavor on my part. It's more of a literary project. A pilgrimage that I'm on, a literary project that I'm doing, but I don't know if you ask people how high do broad-winged hawks go on a thermal, I'm not sure many people will be able to tell you the answer, and so that's an example of one of the things I hope to be able to find out.
Eric doesn't hang glide as much in the spring, at least not yet. He's rated at a basic level, and the winds in spring are pretty erratic, so it's kind of dangerous. So for now, he's spending his time in the spring earthbound and will dedicate more time to hang gliding when summer rolls around. So on that day that we saw the Bonaparte skulls, he's more than happy to go on a long walk up the Connecticut River looking for birds.
Oh, and here we have barn swallows right overhead. Did you hear the little R2-D2-like rattle that they have?
I missed it, but I saw the bird.
Yeah. And look, they're moving north. They're actually flying north.
We're seeing so many birds. Barn swallows, warblers, flycatchers. And when I'm out with Eric, it feels like he has senses that I just don't have. I know it's practice and he's honed his ear over many years, but there are just so many tiny, quick birds flitting about in the trees, and I could not keep up with him. Even when he's pointing out a pretty common species like the goldfinch. See, when birds are backlit like that and you can't get up close, it's hard. It's a training of the eye to see them at a distance like that.
Yeah, so I heard them. Mm. So, you know, you open a field guide and first and foremost, the approach of a field guide to identifying birds is visual. But so in reality, there's a whole host of characteristics that comes into play. So those guys, they flew as a pair, so they're not in a flock. So flocking behavior, not all birds exhibit flocking behavior. So those birds flew as a pair, so they were paired up. They're here, number one, they're here at this time of year. So what's likely to be here, what's not likely to be here? Goldfinches are here year round. Are they flying low? Are they flying high? Are they in the canopy? Or flying out of brush? All of these things feed into a closed loop in my brain that spits out species. And sometimes I'm wrong, and we all can be wrong. But the point I'm making is it's a lot more than just visual characteristics.
Well, that's why it feels like people might feel like a barrier to birding, I think, sometimes. Because you look in you're like, okay, I got this field guide. But it's almost useless in some ways when you get out there because you can't. So much of it is the sound, and you can't represent sound on you. Like when I find that I'm listening for a bird, and then I have to find it in the canopy, it just takes time.
Yeah, but I've been doing this since I was 11, so that's almost 40 years. Number one, and field practice hones your skills, and so if you're an armchair birder just looking in a field guide, you're never going to get past a certain point of competency. You have to get out in the field, and the best thing is to get out in the field with someone who knows more than you. So these birds up here, if you look at the way these birds are flying, they're fly catching. So you see that bird there? It's flying out and it's flying back to the perch. Flying out of a twig, catching an insect and flying back to the perch. A goldfinch won't do that. So you're saying to me, well, how did you know those were goldfinches? Well, they weren't doing that. If I'd seen those two birds, if they took off and exhibited fly catching behavior, that rules out goldfinches right there. That's just a complete behavior that's foreign to that species. So these are all yellow-rumped warblers, which are a very common early returning migrant warbler. And you can hear them actually, some of them are singing.
Part of the reason we can see so many birds here, even though it's still early, is that the Connecticut River is a migratory corridor.
If you live near a migratory corridor, you're lucky. And in New Hampshire, we have three main ones. We've got the Connecticut River, the Merrimack, and the coast.
They're flyways, like highways. And it's a great spot to see birds. It's something Eric says again and again. If you want to see the birds, go to where they live. And watch the weather.
For me, when I open up my computer, the first page that pops up is a weather page. And if you're a bird that's flying thousands of miles, you're in airspace, your number one issue is the weather. It plays such an important role in your life. Is it raining? Can I see the stars? Can I see the land? Is the wind out of the north? Is it out of the west? Is it out of the south? It's hugely important. So why would it not be the case that if you want to watch birds, weather shouldn't be equally as important?
As we walk, we see a pair of ospreys every so often gliding in and out of sight. They're nesting on top of a nearby transmission tower. Once we see one of them carrying twigs and grasses to build their nest, and another time, a fish freshly caught in its talons.
He's just back from South America. He's probably back a week or two.
Ospreys, like the broad-winged hawk that Eric hopes to join in the sky someday, they take part in this epic migration, upwards of 3,000-mile journeys to South America as far as Brazil and Bolivia. Now, ospreys are very widespread, pretty common. They might be impressive, but they're not unusual or rare. But something I appreciate about Eric is that doesn't affect his respect for the osprey or the excitement in the moment of watching one fly overhead.
I think to focus on something like an osprey that travels for days on end, sometimes several days, nonstop, open ocean crossings, and to kind of reduce the marvel of something like that to a check mark, I guard against focusing on the minutiae of keeping a list to the exclusion of appreciating the sheer majesty of what's unfolding in front of us each spring and fall as the earth beats its annual heartbeat and migration heads north in the spring and south in the fall. It's like I think of it as a heartbeat of the planet.
Welcome back to Word of Mouth. I'm Justine Paradise here in the studio with Taylor Quimby.
Hi.
And Hannah McCarthy.
Hey.
So Hannah, you worked on a piece about a new painting exhibition up in Portsmouth.
I did, yes. It's an exhibition of Gertrude Fisk's work, and chances are you have not heard of her. I actually didn't do the interviewing. Our former host, Virginia Prescott, one of her last great acts as host and reporter here at the station, was to go up to Discover Portsmouth and speak with Lainey McCartney, who curated this exhibit, of this woman, Gertrude Fisk, who was a very successful painter in the 20th century, and yet her name has kind of fallen through the cracks.
Yeah, surprise, surprise, never heard of her.
Yeah, ain't that a shame.
ain't that a shock.
Yeah, that's what I meant, shock. Yeah, so let's dive into Gertrude Fisk's story. The first time Lainey McCartney saw the painting, she thought she was looking at a tarbell. The Boston master was famous for his impressionist paintings, and McCartney was sure this was one of them.
She's in kind of a very serene and demure pose. The lighting is dramatic. She's a lovely young woman. It looks like she's a woman of society.
This painting, which was hanging above a fireplace at the York Public Library in Maine, is called Woman in White. It has the characteristic style of the Boston School, where Edmund Tarbell was a revered teacher in the early 20th century. But this painting was not done by Tarbell. In fact, it wasn't painted by any of the Boston School's famous male painters. Woman in White is the work of a woman.
And it was an extraordinary piece, and I needed to know more about this woman. I couldn't understand how I didn't know her name.
Gertrude Fisk was well known in her lifetime. As a member of the Boston School, she made a living on her mastery of Impressionist painting. But these days, it's the rare art lover who can spot a Fisk. So for McCartney, who's a curator with the Portsmouth Historical Society, it became important to highlight this painter for breaking a mold and doing it with all of the mastery of her male contemporaries.
It's almost woman as object, and Fisk turns it over, woman as subject. The woman is the main focal point, either in action, contemplation, conversation, outside, engaged, as women truly were.
Fisk's America was in the swing of widespread industrialization and immigration, but the art of the Boston School reflected a nostalgia for another time, a time when pastoral scenes were uninterrupted by telephone wires and women were well-behaved.
Well, Fisk, everything about what Fisk did was very progressive. How she portrayed women, how she portrayed the landscape, her own ambition. She included herself in a lot of these canvases in a quiet way, but the statement was, I am an artist in this domain that only recently accepts women in the fine arts.
Fisk painted women with rosy hands and feet, where her contemporaries would have kept them lily white. She painted elderly women and immigrants. Her colors were bold and her subjects were active. Despite breaking with prevailing trends, though, Fisk was accepted in early 20th century New England. She was the first woman appointed to the Massachusetts State Art Commission. She co-founded the Guild of Boston Artists and the Boston Society of Etchers and the Algonquin Art Association.
It goes on and on. Honestly, I just don't know how she stayed as industrious as she did.
Fisk was prolific, but she slipped through the cracks of history. Adam Brooks, who works with McCartney as the director of exhibitions, says it may have something to do with her prominent family having no need to profit off of her work after her death. But she wasn't alone in being forgotten. Peers like Marie Danforth Page and Gretchen Rogers, who Tarbell, by the way, described as a genius, faded from distinction as well.
There was a backlash after women's suffrage actually passed and gained the right to vote, and especially after World War II, a return to this ideal domesticity for women. And the people who tended to be remembered were many of the men from that generation.
The Boston School did edge back into view in the mid-80s. Fisk made her way onto museum walls and her work appreciated in value. But she's far from a household name, even among those who know the movement well. McCartney sees Fisk as being on a playing field that isn't level yet, being looked at not as one of the Boston masters, but as a woman painter in the company of great men.
Take gender out of it. Just take it for what it is. You know, I think we still have a bias, and that's the conversation I want to bring up. That bias, I think there's no room for it.
McCartney has curated a show of Fisk's work that will be open at Discover Portsmouth and free to the public through September of this year. But she says this just scratches the surface of Fisk and her huge body of work.
There's so much more to do with Fisk. This really, truly, I hope someone digs deeper. It's so deserving.
McCartney called the exhibit Gertrude Fisk, American Master, intentionally leaving the painter's gender out of the description. She says that an artist is an artist, period. And Fisk happened to be a masterful one.
That was producer Hannah McCarthy with Virginia Prescott on the painter Gertrude Fisk in Portsmouth. The exhibit is up at the Portsmouth Historical Society through September 30th. You're listening to Word of Mouth. I'm Justine Paradise here in the studio with Hannah McCarthy and Taylor Quimby. Hey, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
So up next, we have an installment of our new series, New Hampshire First, which was actually produced this week by our executive producer, Erica Janik.
Hello there.
Hey. So what is our New Hampshire First this week?
This week, it's the myth and the legend about the invention of the casserole.
We need a theme for New Hampshire Firsts.
Like,
it's the first in the nation, but we're not talking about the primary. We're talking about casseroles.
Not the primary. Not the primary.
yeah,
there's our theme right there.
Crushed it. All right, let's hear it. New Hampshire Firsts, Casserole Edition.
There's a story out there. A story you'll find on dozens, maybe hundreds of websites about the invention of the casserole.
In 1866, Elmira Delacour, a French-Canadian immigrant, invented the precursor of the modern casserole in Berlin, New Hampshire.
That's from Wikipedia. If you don't trust Wikipedia, you can also find this attribution in print, too. A newspaper in Kentucky references Elmira Delacour in a story about the opening of a new restaurant that presumably has some casserole on the menu. The Sacramento State Hornet goes so far as to say that she invented the egg casserole. And a piece by Langdon Reed in a Staunton, Virginia newspaper says, history tells us that a French-Canadian immigrant, Elmira Delacour, is credited with inventing the casserole. He continues, I'm pretty sure to date, this is the biggest contribution to the states that New Hampshire has produced. Nope. Not by a long shot, Langdon, and we have this series to prove it. But has history really told us Elmira Delacour invented the casserole? I went to Berlin to find out.
My name is Walter Netto. I'm vice president of the Berlin-Coos County Historical Society. I'm a retired law enforcement police officer from Berlin PD.
As far as Walter knows, Elmira and Berlin had nothing to do with the casserole's invention.
The rumor has been around for a couple of years now. Don't know where it originated from. It's just every once in a while somebody will bring it up. Oh, I heard the casserole was invented in Berlin by a lady named Delacour. And none of us here have ever heard of it. All the documents that we have about her doesn't say anything about the casserole dish.
Elmira gave much more to the town than a dish.
She was a very influential lady in Berlin.
She was born in Quebec in 1844 and came to Berlin to join her husband, who had found work in a sawmill after the Civil War. It's said that she arrived with a bag filled with 10 pounds of flour, 5 pounds of butter, 5 loaves of maple sugar, eggs, tobacco, and cherry wine, all of which, you can imagine, quickly made her a town favorite. 6 months later, the Delacours moved into their own home.
She started the first elementary school, and it was, as you come into Berlin on Glen Avenue, she had it in her own home. pretty much.
Other rooms house new immigrants. She was always happy to host newcomers until they got settled.
And she also, when there were other Frenchmen who were here from Canada, and she got the wives to come down, and she let them board with her and until they found their own place.
The Brown Bulletin, the newsletter of the paper company that employed most of the town, hailed Elmira as a community
leader who left a comfortable home and loving relatives to stand by her husband through thick and thin, spurred them on, and helped to keep up their courage, for there were many dark hours.
Still, I asked Walter what kind of casserole Elmira might have made had she made one.
Well, generally, a casserole dish is probably made from a lot of leftovers. I mean, if one day they had roast beef and the next day they had pork and had a lot of leftover vegetables, she just probably would throw it all together. And that's what we all did. When I grew up, my mother, we had five children in the family, and my mother would make a large roast on Sunday for a great meal, and we had the rest of that all week.
So where did this story begin? How did Elmira Jellicoeur's name become historically entwined with casserole? The Wikipedia entry crediting Elmira links to a 2012 article on the layered history of casserole. Get it? I contacted the author of the story, Rachel Nolan, who pointed me to the Oxford Companion to American Food and Drink. But author Andy F. Smith, who emailed me the casserole section of the book, says that he's never heard this story before and that it can't possibly be true. But I must have sparked something in him because he emailed me again a little bit later, saying that he'd done a bit of a search and thinks the story is a relatively recent invention. Then he told me about a book I hadn't seen before. The Berlin Dictionary. It's a crowdsourced dictionary, really a roast, of local lore, but casserole didn't make the cut. Part of the problem of attribution for something like casserole is that casserole is itself more of a category than a specific dish. The name even comes from a dish, saucepan, in French. A casserole is still a type of baking dish you can buy. And the contents of that dish likely didn't have one inventor, but many. A bunch of stuff cooked in a dish together appears in cuisines around the world and has for centuries, even if we didn't call it by that name. Recipes for casseroles start appearing in American cookbooks in the late 19th century, but the dish really grew in popularity during the Depression and the World Wars. Vegetables and starches helped to pad a meal so that a small portion of meat could become a more filling dish during times of hardship. Casseroles became even more popular in the mid-20th century as a vehicle for leftovers, just as Walter said, often bound together with a can or two of condensed cream of whatever soup, something that didn't go over well with some Irish tasting a variety of American-style casseroles.
Tastes like if you took a load of green beans and dumped soup on top of it.
It's like a bit boring, isn't it?
It's real boring.
The secret ingredient to casserole that it's like ingredients that should be separate, but you force them together.
You put the dish at the end of the table and you just go, breadcrumbs, oven.
So Elmira Jellicoeur probably didn't invent the casserole, but she probably made one, because who hasn't? We still don't know where the story started, but there are many mysteries around Berlin, like where the town got its name, seriously.
In 1829, when it was incorporated, and nobody knows why they call it Berlin. Can't find anything anywhere. There's nothing in its history that says why they wanted Berlin called Berlin. There's 13 communities in the United States, I think, that are named Berlin.
Putting the casserole aside, Elmira Jellicoeur deserves to be remembered as an educator and an ambassador to her town.
That was Erica Janik for our series, New Hampshire Firsts. That's it for Word of Mouth this week. This episode was produced by Hannah McCarthy, Nick Capodice, Virginia Prescott, Jimmy Gutierrez, Taylor Quimby, Ben Henry, and me, Justine Paradise. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is arbiter of all the things you wish you'd say or wish you'd never said. A very special thanks to Tom Mungovan and his students at Concord High School for their incredible flag design ideas. See the designs on wordofmouthradio.org. Music in this episode from Blue Dot Sessions, Poddington Bear, Sci-Fi Industries, Ari De Niro, Heyvanlar Alemi, Man Beast, and Scheming Weasel. This has been Word of Mouth, a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.